This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos.
What better way to start a show on Christmas than with Mel Torme's The Christmas Song, which everybody refers to as, well, you know, the song Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. And anyway, no, that's not its proper name, but, you know the song I'm talking about.
Tiny little tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight.
Well, we've told this story before, but we're going to tell it again. One of our favorite sites to reference is probably the best blog writer I know, Mark Evanier. He's been on the show only once many years ago, talking about the Mort Saul birthday party they held down in Los Angeles. Mark is an interesting fellow, and if you ever want to check out some good writing, go to his website, newsfromme.com. And I mention this in conjunction with the Christmas song, because on his blog many years ago, he told a very amusing story about Mel Torme and that song, which we have repeated on this show in the past, but it's been a long time, so let's go over it again. Here's the scene. Mark Evanier is down at the Farmer's Market in Los Angeles, which is an assortment of various stores and shops and things. They got some good food there. It's an interesting place. And he's there on, one winter day, and he looks over the nearby table, and what do you know? There's this singer, Mel Torme. And Evanier thinks, well, he needs his privacy. I'm not going to bother him, but, it's just nice to know he's sitting there. And as he's sitting there, through the farmer's market, traipse a bunch of Christmas carolers. And they're singing, various Christmas favorites. And as luck would have it, as they're nearing Mel Torme's table, they start to sing the Christmas song. Unable to resist, Mel turns to them and says, "You mind if I join in?" And of course, the leader of the choir that's singing these carols takes a look and thinks, oh no, the fat guy wants to sing, which he does. And of course, being the legendary Mel Torme, and being that it's his song, he nails it. As Mark Evanier describes it, afterwards, the singers sort of look at him and said, you're pretty good. To which he added, yeah, they actually said that to Mel Torme. To which Mel modestly replies, well, I actually recorded a few albums. And the lead man says, really? How many? To which he answered, 57. Anyway, funny story. For a better and more complete telling of it, I would refer you to newsfromme.com. And another festive news that corresponds to our Christmas holiday, we have the fact that the legendary Dick Van Dyke just recently turned 99 years of age. Now, we've been collecting material for this program for quite some time, some of which never got used, and the item in my right hand never got used. It dates back to February of 2007 from Esquire magazine, and it was a chat that the magazine held with Dick Van Dyke, who at the time was 81. And I enjoy some of the exchanges that took place then, so I think I will relate them now. The magazine asked about his history, and he noted that if you walked into my house when I was a kid, you might see my mother searching in the bureau drawers to find a ham she'd put away for dinner and forgotten where it was. And of course, that is certainly something that raises more questions than it might answer about his youth. But the next statement was that everybody called my dad Cookie, to which he added, nobody knew his real name. To that I say, call me a skeptic. But Van Dyke said, there's a photo from when I was a kid at a park for a July 4th picnic. The table was all laid out, right down to the potato salad, and suddenly it started to rain in torrents. Everybody ran for the cars except my dad. He sat there and ate in the pouring rain, dripping wet, just for the hell of it. And no, there's no mention of whether his mom had found the ham by then. The next thing he had to say was, as wonderful as they were, my parents didn't teach me anything about self-discipline, concentration, patience, or focus. Gee, from what we've just heard about them, that seems like a surprise. He added, if I hadn't had a family myself, I probably never would have done anything. Marriage taught me responsibility. Another anecdote, he noted, in the early 60s, I was looking up a phone number in Santa Monica and came upon the name of Stan Laurel. I loved Stan Laurel as a kid. My favorite Laurel and Hardy movie is Way Out West. Still a classic. Anyway, I dialed the number for Stan Laurel, and it was him. I was doing our television series, so he knew who I was. I said, I've always been an admirer, and you know, I've stolen rather liberally from you over the years. To which he said, yes, I know. He invited me over, and we became good friends. Van Dyke said at the very beginning of The Dick Van Dyke Show, Carl Reiner, the producer, said, 5 years, if we go that long. He thought it would get repetitive after that. So after 5 years, everybody knew it was over. The writing was brilliant. It was a perfect ensemble. We were a top-rated show. Nobody wanted to leave, but we all knew it was over because of what Carl said at the beginning. Finally, Van Dyke said many years ago, in my 70s, I exercised to stay ambulatory. In my 80s, I exercised to avoid assisted living. And no, we don't have an update of what Dick has to say about what he's doing in his 90s. But whatever it is, we wish him well and hope he can keep doing it for a while. Now, I should note that this is a Christmas show, and we want to keep things light, at least in the beginning. But I do want to forwardly promote that in the second half of today's program, we're going to talk to our good friend Stephen J. Harper, who is always a wealth of insight about what's going on politically and will update us based on our last conversation with him, which I believe was pre-election. So we'll need an update there. In the meantime, to maintain a link with what we normally do, I think at this point I'll jump into a couple of rounds of the good, the bad, and the ugly. Right, according to the Week magazine, it was a good week some weeks back for, I guess you'd say, truth in advertising, with the news that the Swiss chocolatier Lindt admitted in court filings that its chocolate is not, in fact, quote, expertly crafted from the finest ingredients, end quote. Responding to a class action lawsuit alleging the presence of toxic heavy metals, Lindt's lawyers argued that advertising claims of Lindt's, quote, excellence, unquote, were not substantive assertions, but merely puffery. Yow. It was, on the other hand, a bad week, I guess you could say, for truth in advertising, with the news that Elon Musk's AI chatbot, Grok, identified its billionaire owner as, quote, one of the most significant spreaders of misinformation on X since he acquired the platform, unquote. A trend it blamed in part on Musk's association with, quote, controversial figures, unquote. And finally, it was an ugly week, if not for truth in advertising, maybe for good ideas in marketing. We have this. A Japanese convenience store chain has debuted a new thirst quencher. Drinkable mayonnaise. Described as a long-awaited new product for mayonnaise lovers. Yes, the product, named Nomu Mayo, apparently offers, quote, the richness and sourness of mayonnaise reproduced in a chilled beverage. You first, Mr. McMillan.
No, thank you.
All right, let's do a second round, shall we? According to The Week, more recently in one of their weeks, it was a good week for empathy after a team of British and German researchers found that supermarket shoppers are 58% more likely to purchase individual loose bananas if they are labeled sad singles. Said researcher Lisa Ekman, the plight of the single banana is really relatable. And we here at Radio Parallax think it was a bad week recently for setting the record straight because of our inherent skepticism of the story, which is that Victor Willis, age 73, who is co-writer of the 1978 Village People mega hit YMCA, threatened to sue media outlets that call the song a gay anthem. Said Willis, this false assumption is based on the fact that his writing partner and several members of the Village People were gay. Also that the YMCA was known as a gay hangout, and also the fact that the band's debut LP was, quote, totally about gay life, unquote. Okay, well, I'm glad they set the record straight on that one. They have
Possibly be a gay anthem.
And finally, it was an ugly week for something we were just talking about, bananas. The story is that a Swedish minister's phobia of bananas has become public after leaked emails revealed the extreme nature of her aversion. Aides to Paulina Brandenburg, the Minister for Gender Equality, make sure that any room she enters is free of the fruit. In one email, they demanded that no traces of bananas be in the meeting rooms. In another, the organizers of the event promised to, quote, secure the conference so there are no bananas. Brandenburg told Swedish media the phobia is, quote, something that I get professional help with, unquote. Well, we certainly hope so.
We have no bananas today. We got string beans and onions.
All right, let's talk about marketing for just a moment, and not about drinkable mayonnaise. Oh. But for this, we're going to go to one of our standbys for lighthearted fare on this program, which would be the Uncle John's Bathroom Reader series, of which we've used a lot over the years. I'm looking at this case as the volume called Fantastic Bathroom Reader. And in a piece in the book on advertising, they had this to say. In 2006, Dos Equis was a fairly obscure imported Mexican beer sold mainly in Texas and California. The Cuauhtemoc Moctezuma Brewery wanted to differentiate the brand from the rest of the crowded market and hired advertising firm Euro RSCG to design an ad campaign. Their market research showed that contrary to ads that associated the brands with exotic locations and beautiful people, beer customers wanted to be seen as interesting. That inspired brand director Paul Smales to create an ad mascot called the Most Interesting Man in the World. The character would tell tales of his accomplishments but be portrayed by an older actor so that younger customers wouldn't find him threatening. Each commercial followed the same script. Old-looking film clips of the man fighting bears or surfing 80-foot waves are played under a humorous voiceover, read by frontline narrator Will Lyman, before they transitioned back into a nightclub. There, the man surrounded by gorgeous women in a corner booth before he spots the camera says, "I don't always drink beer, but when I do, I prefer Dos Equis. Stay thirsty, my friends." Actor Jonathan Goldsmith based his portrayal of the man on 1950s actor Fernando Lamas. And they noted in this issue of the book that 8 years after its debut, Dos Equis is now the sixth best-selling imported beer in the United States. And for me, this opens the opportunity to relate some of my favorite lines from that series of commercials. How many should we do, Mr. McMillan?
You could never do too many.
Well, maybe not. Well, I have a list of 30. I think I'll do the first 15. How's that sound?
Sure.
All right. He is the most interesting man in the world. His small talk has altered foreign policy. If he were to punch you in the face, you would have to fight off a strong urge to thank him. He has inside jokes with complete strangers. In museums, he is allowed to touch the art. The last time he flirted with danger, danger got clingy. He has never filled up on chips. The police often question him just because they find him interesting. Skinny dipping was his idea. His 2 cents is worth $37 and change. He'll tell you it's not you, it's him, but really, it's you. When he drives a car off the lot, it increases in value. And one of my personal favorites, even his enemies list him as their emergency contact.
One of my favorites is, he once ran a marathon because it was on the way.
He is the most interesting man in the world. And I got to give the advertising people credit on that one. That's pretty funny stuff. All right, let's jump into another edition of Uncle John's. In this case, it was the book titled Fully Loaded 25th Anniversary Edition. The book explains how in China, menus in restaurants frequented by Western tourists are carefully translated into English and easy to understand. But if you eat where the locals eat, you may experience a phenomenon known as Chinglish, translations that are incomprehensible and sometimes hilarious. They explain that translating Chinese into English is made difficult because many Chinese symbols are pictographs or graphic depictions of the words they denote. And pictographs are combined to create symbols for new words. The word calf, for example, combines the symbols for cow and boy, which is how cowboy leg finds its way into some menus where leg of veal is served. Chinese symbols can also mean more than one thing. The character for dry, one of the two symbols used in the name for dry pot style of cooking, can also mean do. In English, of course, do can be a slang for, well, they note the book is G-rated, so we can't really spell it out. But that is why, when a dish called dry pot rabbit is on the menu, the English translation sometimes describes the rabbit performing an intimate act on the cooking pot that, had it involved another bunny, would have increased the population of rabbits in the vicinity. They note also the Chinese love colorful idiomatic names. According to legend, a popular tofu dish called bean curd made by pockmarked woman really was created by such a woman. And because a Sichuan dish of minced pork on bean thread noodles looks like ants climbing a tree, that's what it's called. They note so sometimes even when a dish is correctly translated, it can seem pretty odd to the uninitiated. Such as blow up a flat fish with no result. Here's one I have to like. Government abuse chicken. How about husband and wife lung slice? Or dishes with human pickles? And finally, a couple of showstoppers. Fragrant bone in garlic in strange flavor. And the perennial favorite, a West bean plays the fish a soup. Anyway, not to run this down, Chinese food is usually pretty darn good, no matter what it's called. And here's a perennial favorite from that same edition of Loony Laws. The subheadline on this was, believe it or not, these are real laws. Since I know the listenership wishes to be law-abiding citizens, please keep some of these in mind. Like if you find yourself in Spokane, Washington, keep in mind that it's against the law to interrupt a religious service with a horse race. And if you're an unmarried woman who finds yourself in Florida, keep in mind that although you can parachute most days of the week, you cannot do so on Sundays. If you're visiting the state of Idaho, keep in mind that it's illegal to sell chickens after dark, unless, of course, you've obtained the proper permit. And my personal favorite, if you find yourself in nearby Chico, California, and are tempted to detonate a nuclear bomb, keep in mind, you'll be subject to a $500 fine. All right, and here's a third category that we love, warning labels. Same edition of the Uncle John's. All right, the good people in Uncle John's note that some things in life should go without saying, but there's always the occasional genius who needs to be told not to shave during an earthquake. I do like this one that was on a packet of salt. Warning! Contains salt! And one on a bottle of rubbing alcohol, which was avoid contact with eyes, ears, brain, and surrounding membranes. You gotta like this one. On a birthday badge for two-year-olds, and it says on the badge, I am two on one side. The warning label states, not to be used by children under 3 years of age. And my personal favorite, from a bicycle. Removing the wheel can influence the performance of the bicycle. Well, sure. Well, we urge you not to test that one. All right, from number 29 in the Bathroom Reader series, which was titled Uncanny, we have a piece that was on, it was based on the fact that a certain number of phone numbers got made famous by songs, movies, and TV shows. And of course, the classic in this was 867-5309, which according to rock legend Tommy Two-Tone lead guitarist Jim Keller, wrote it about a real girlfriend named Jenny, whose number was not actually that number. Anyway, I'm sure that in whatever area code you were in, if you had that number, your life became a living hell in the wake of that song being a hit. But the one I want to focus in on is 1-900-MIX-A-LOT. Sir Mix-A-Lot, of course, had his number one hit in 1992 with Baby's Got Back. In it, he tells listener to dial 1-900-MIX-A-LOT and kick them nasty thoughts. That number was a real number set up by Sir Mix-A-Lot and his record label. Callers would be charged a few dollars per minute to, quote, kick them nasty thoughts, unquote, which meant recording their own sexually explicit messages or listen to ones left by others. The enterprise was rumored to have made a small fortune for Sir Mix-A-Lot at the time, but sadly, don't call it because the number is no longer active. If you've ever watched a number, a phone number being used in movies or TV, you perhaps noted that the prefix on it was 555 because that's a prefix not used by the various phone companies, at least never had been till recently. I assume that's still the case. But wouldn't you know it, back in 1984 when they made Ghostbusters, in the movie they create a low-budget TV commercial that the Ghostbusters make, directing potential clients to call them at 555-2364. During the movie's theatrical run, Ivan Reitman, the director, set up 1-800-555-2368 and ran it at the bottom of ads for the film on TV. Callers got a pre-recorded greeting from stars Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd, and the movie was a blockbuster, while the hotline ranked up an average of 1,000 calls an hour during the 6 weeks it was in operation. Interesting. All right, as we're going to wrap up our first segment here before going to Stephen Harper, we would note we should probably throw out some pithy quotes, because we like good quotes. And here's a few that we do like. Said Ambrose Bierce once, "Lottery is defined as a tax on people who are bad at math." And David Foster Wallace once said, "You will become way less concerned with what other people think of you when you realize how seldom they do." And then a quote from someone named Mark Stein, who said, "The pen is only mightier than the sword if you're allowed to use the pen." I guess we got a minute and a half left, Mr. McMillan.
Somewhere around there.
All right, let's then go to the Bathroom Reader one final time here. One segment we always love on this program from the Uncle John's is the Dumb Crooks section. And we have, it turns out in this case, a U.S. and U.K. edition. First, the U.S. Used car dealer Larry Barnett owed a large sum of money to his former employee, James Makem. Barnett figured that if Makem was dead, he wouldn't have to pay. So he hired a hitman. While discussing the plan with the hitman, Barnett pulled up Macon's contact information on his cell phone, which he then put into his back pocket and inadvertently hit the send button. Makem answered and listened in as the men plotted his demise. "I don't care if you have to burn his house to the ground within a minute," said Barnett. "Just make it look like an accident." Makem hung up and called the police. Later, when investigating officers went to Makem's house, they discovered that the place had been broken into and the gas stove had been tampered with. Barnett was arrested and charged with conspiracy to commit murder. And over across the pond in the UK, we have this one. A pair of technically challenged burglars broke into a British auto repair shop back in 2007, and while they promptly deactivated the TV camera, the alarm system, and the phone system, amidst all their button pressing and switch flipping, one of them unwittingly activated a voice recording system. So for the next few minutes, as they were stealing thousands of dollars in cash and merchandise, they not only said each other's names, Sean and Jono, but talked about past crimes and discussed the best ways to break and enter. Police had little trouble tracking them down and arresting them. All right, we got to take a short break, but before we do so, we can't resist using one of our annual favorites, Jingle Bells from the Barking Dogs. I'm Douglas Everett. This is Radio Parallax.